Climate Change the Facts. Costing Climate Change by Alan Moran. Part 1. Alan Moran is the manager of Regulation Economics, former director of the Deregulation Unit at the Institute of Public Affairs, director of the Australian Office of Regulation Review, and Deputy Secretary of Energy in the Victorian Department of Minerals and Energy. The IPCC's three voluminous Fifth Assessment Working Group reports and their slimmed-down summaries for policymakers were completed in 2013 and 2014. To condense the findings of what is said to be the work of 803 authors, the IPCC estimates that a doubling of atmospheric carbon dioxide, CO2, will cause warming between 1.5 degrees Celsius and 4.5 degrees Celsius. Perhaps in response to 17 years in which the planet has defied the warming forecasts of climate models, the lower boundary was reduced in the latest assessment. This did not, however, prevent the decibels of commentary about adverse implications being cranked up. Highly respected climate scientists put the likely warming below the bottom of the IPCC range. Writing in this volume, Richard Lindzen estimates the maximum warming possible for human-induced greenhouse gases is 1 degree Celsius, while Beanstalk, Reingewurz, and Palder find that the relationship between greenhouse gases and warming is spurious, except perhaps in the short term. Entertainers urge us to reduce consumption of non-renewable energy in order to forestall adverse effects of global warming. Ironically, some of those exhorters have carbon footprints many times those of common folk. Bono's 2010 World Concert Tour is estimated to have generated emissions equivalent to the annual level of 6,500 British people. How much will climate change hurt? The key questions are, how much damage will emanate from the likely atmospheric doubling of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases? And what is the cost of measures to prevent this doubling? The IPCC puts the qualitative costs of warming in the following foreboding terms. Each degree of warming is projected to decrease renewable water resources by at least 20% for an additional 7% of the global population. Climate change is likely to increase the frequency of droughts. Heavy rainfalls are likely to become more intense and frequent. In response to further warming by 1 degree Celsius or more by the mid-21st century and beyond, ocean-wide changes in ecosystem properties are projected to continue, with implications for food security. Urban climate change risks, vulnerabilities, and impacts are increasing across the world in urban centers of all sizes, economic conditions, and site characteristics. Climate change will have profound impacts on a broad spectrum of infrastructure systems: water and energy supply, sanitation and drainage, transport and telecommunication, services, including healthcare and emergency services, the built environment and ecosystem services. Climate trends are affecting the abundance and distribution of harvested aquatic species, both freshwater and marine, and aquaculture production systems in different parts of the world, but with benefits in other regions. Without adaptation, local temperature increases in excess of about 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial is projected to have negative effects on yields for the major crops, wheat, rice, and maize, with increased global food prices by 2050. In fleshing out these generalities, the IPCC maintains that climate change is already impacting on natural and human systems. It says these effects include changing precipitation, melting snow, and diminishing crop yields. The Working Group 2 report sees additional costs being derived from the following key risks: risk of death, injury, ill health, or disrupted livelihoods in low-lying coastal zones and small island developing states and other small islands due to storm surges, coastal flooding, and sea level rise. Risk of severe ill health and disrupted livelihoods for large urban populations due to inland flooding in some regions. Systemic risks due to extreme weather events leading to breakdown of infrastructure networks and critical services such as electricity, water supply, and health and emergency services. Risk of mortality and morbidity during periods of extreme heat, particularly for vulnerable urban populations and those working outdoors in urban or rural areas. Risk of food insecurity and the breakdown of food systems linked to warming, drought, flooding, and precipitation variability in extremes, particularly for poorer populations in urban and rural settings. Risk of loss of rural livelihoods and income due to insufficient access to drinking and irrigation water, and reduced agricultural productivity, particularly for farmers and pastoralists with minimal capital in semi-arid regions. Risk of loss of marine and coastal ecosystems, biodiversity, and ecosystem goods, functions, and services they provide for coastal livelihoods, especially for fishing communities in the tropics and the Arctic. Risk of loss of terrestrial and inland water ecosystems, biodiversity, and the ecosystem goods, functions, and services they provide for livelihoods. Studies to assess and quantify these concerns include the official ones conducted by large teams of experts. The most prominent of these are the UK report by Nicholas Stern and the Australian report by Ross Gunnow. The latter was followed up by other reports, including the Strong Growth, Low Pollution Modeling by the Treasury. As authors, this listed 84 Treasury officials in addition to officers from other agencies. While arguing that the analysis should not focus only on narrow measures of income like GDP, Stern suggested the cost of human-induced climate change under business as usual would be the equivalent of around a 20% reduction in consumption per head, now and into the future. Combating this, he said, would cost only 1% of GDP. Stern received a peerage for the report which Her Majesty's government has archived. Like Stern, Gunnow provided a number of cost estimates, including one of up to 12%. He maintained all of the detailed assessments of the economics of climate change indicate that the main cost of climate change, and therefore the main benefits of mitigation, accrue in the 22nd, 23rd centuries and beyond. Gunnow included many individual features in his warming-induced damage estimates, though the detailed costs were not well supported. Thus, he argues that the additional expense for repairing roads and bridges would cost over 1 percentage point of GDP, but offers no substantiation for these assertions. Oddly, he also argues that other cost increases will ensue from reduced tourism, partly due to a highly implausible collapse of the Great Barrier Reef, but also because of higher electricity costs and a loss of international tourism. In the reference case, international travel to Australia is projected to increase substantially. Projecting a series of climate refugee scenarios, Gunnow also sees a need for increased defense spending with an additional cost amounting to 0.2% per annum. However, the IPCC has now downgraded such fears. In 2005, the IPCC had global warming creating, quote, 50 million climate refugees by 2010, later deferred to 2020. It now says that such fears are not supported by past experiences of responses to droughts and extreme weather events, and predictions for future migration flows are tentative at best. Richard Toll has pointed out that the Stern and Gunnow reports were not peer-reviewed. Toll has now been demonized for withdrawing his name as an author of a key IPCC chapter that he claims the summary for policymakers had distorted. That summary argues the incomplete estimates of global annual economic loss for additional temperature increases of 2 degrees Celsius are between 0.2 and 2.0% of income. Losses accelerate with greater warming, but few quantitative estimates have been completed for additional warming around 3 degrees Celsius or above. The IPCC's estimates of cost from inaction to prevent climate change are, nonetheless, considerably lower than those offered by the British and Australian semi-official government reports. The IPCC assessment lists only 4 studies since 2008 that estimate economic losses due to climate change. One, by Madison and Radons, is based on, quote, self-reported happiness, and therefore fails key scientific verifiability tests. Of the others, Nordhaus suggests a loss of GDP of 2.5% with a 3 degrees Celsius warming. A second, by Bosello, Aboli, and Pierfederici, puts the GDP loss at 0.5% for a 1.9 degrees Celsius warming. And a third, by Rosson and van der Benzurg, estimates a GDP loss of 1.8% for a 2.3 degrees Celsius increase and 4.6% loss for a 4.9 degrees Celsius warming. The studies are summarized in Table 1. There is considerable water muddying within the IPCC's fifth assessment report about possible scenarios where much higher warming takes place. But policy has to stay grounded with the more plausible possibilities. The world is replete with remote dangers that might just occur, and providing for all of these would take up most of global income. The bottom line is that the cost of global warming that might result from human activities, as reported by the IPCC, is very small. Moreover, the economists estimating these costs have done so on the basis of some highly unreliable evaluations of damage from climate change. Thus, the cost attributed to losses from reduced agricultural output and productivity, rising sea levels, reallocation of tourist facilities, river floods, and so on, are compiled on a static basis. The costs assume people will not modify their behaviors in response to the forecasted gradual changes in temperature, precipitation patterns, and tides. Responses to such changes have taken place in the past and should be far more easily accommodated with the more accurate measurements we enjoy today. In addition, some of the outcomes that the IPCC is projecting are highly dubious. In the IPCC's fifth assessment report, there are allegations of desertification of Southeast Australia's Murray-Darling Basin and of declining yields of major cereals. Both are readily rebutted. The first stemmed from a politicization of the process that interpreted drought, the pattern of which is well understood by Australia's more careful scientists, with a permanent change. The drought has broken, and the alarmist scientists promoting the theory have been made to look foolish. The drought costs estimated by the IPCC owe much to the Garneau Report, which compiled greater losses than the IPCC from climate change as part of its narrative. Garneau put Australia's costs from a 5 degrees Celsius warming by the end of the century at 8% of GDP. His report put losses from agriculture at 20% of the total, and those losses were predominantly in the Murray-Darling Basin, home to over one-third of Australian farm output and the nation's major irrigation area. According to Garneau, half of the present-day production in the basin would be lost by 2050, and by the end of the century it would no longer support irrigated agriculture. Such projections are total fantasies. There is no empirical evidence of the Murray-Darling turning into the barren region that Garneau projects. Rainfall, measured by Jennifer Mararossi, appears in Figure 1. Drought years in the noughties, as at the turn of the 19th century and the 1940s, have been followed by high levels of rainfall and damage through flooding. After half a century of carbon emissions with, according to the IPCC and other warmists, each decade showing higher average temperatures, some corroboration of the impending desertification of Southeast Australia should surely be evident. In fact, the main threat to irrigated agriculture has come from governments taking water from farmers and allocating it to environmental flows. The suggestion that yields from major crops are declining as a result of climate change is equally spurious and not supported by empirical evidence. The following discussion with the IPCC's Chris Field, one of two lead authors, was broadcast by the Australian Broadcasting Commission. Chris Field. Year on year, yields have increased by something like 2%, but they've been increasing by less than that recently, and based on a number of very careful, thorough statistical analysis, researchers are now able to see that for at least two of the world's major food crops, wheat, and maize, the increases in yields year on year have slowed, partly as a consequence of climate change. So the drag, the anchoring effect of climate change in making it more and more difficult to increase yields, is something we're seeing at the global basis. I'm sure there are some places where there are still yield increases, but there are other places that are offsetting those where yields are decreasing. This idea that we're seeing slower than expected yield increases is emerging at the global scale. Sarah Ferguson. But we're not just talking about, this isn't any longer about modeling. This is about already observable facts. Chris Field. Absolutely. That's one of the really different things about this report than what the IPCC has said in the past. The impacts of the changes that have already occurred are widespread and consequential. At least with respect to wheat, this is a highly contested view. Exhaustive research by Wilcox and Mikowski has found that although higher temperatures mean reduced yields, the effects of high CO2 concentrations, greater than 640 parts per million, outweighed the effects of increasing temperature up to 2 degrees Celsius. And moderate declines in precipitation, up to 20%, leading to increasing yields. Globally, yields of the major crops have increased at the same rate for decades, with no signs of a falloff. Figure 2 illustrates global and Australian wheat trends. Australian yields declined for a number of country-specific reasons. These and other doubtful measurements of human-induced climate-driven change by the IPCC indicate that its estimate of slender economic loss from climate change is an exaggeration.
Climate Change: The Facts is published by Stockade Books. All rights reserved.